Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Ringside Wrap, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we bring you the latest news and information on major pro wrestling and MMA promotions, the occasional history lesson, and interviews with legends of yesterday and stars of today. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Ringside Wrap.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to Ringside Wrap. I am Mike Sempervivi, and it is Wednesday, February 15th, 2012, and hopefully all of your Valentine's days were fulfilling the nice and had a lot of love in there. And Les Thatcher, in fact, had so much love that he is recovering today from it. Well, that's not true. He's actually down at working hard and going to the pay window tonight, so... he will not be here with us, but in his place, a fine replacement, if I say so myself, from Peach State Pandemonium, Mr. Mike Norris. Mike, how are you doing tonight?
Well, I was doing fine until you put that vision of Les getting too much love in my head. Now I'm not sure I'll be able to sleep tonight.
How was your Valentine's Day? Was it filled with love yourself?
Yeah, I was actually in Atlanta this weekend. I went over to see my daughter, had lunch with her on Sunday. She is finishing up her senior year in college at Georgia College and State University in Milledgeville. And this past Tuesday was actually her birthday, so I went, or not this past Tuesday, but Tuesday before last was actually her birthday. So I picked up her mother, my ex-wife, and we rode over to visit her and had lunch with her, and that was great. Otherwise, you know, I came home on Monday, and Valentine was uneventful for me, so.
You know, there were a few people that I knew who spent their Valentine's Day actually watching old Greg the Hammer Valentine tapes, which I didn't think was all that bad of an option either.
I spent Tuesday watching Memphis Heat for the majority of the day.
Now,
I picked up this weekend at the Ted Allen show. Bill Dundee had some that he was selling, so I picked one up from him. I picked one up when he wasn't looking and put it in my jacket pocket. And
oops.
He won't
miss borrowing it. You'll return it when you're done with it.
He worked for Nick Gulas. He's used to being shortchanged.
There's a lot to talk about. In fact, later on, I want to get into the Ted Allen show as well. But what did you think of the documentary? Because I had seen it about, it's been about a month or so ago now. I was really blown away by it. We had talked to Bill Dundee on the show, and you know, my only problem with it was actually his only problem with it, and it wasn't really that much of a problem from my end, but there was a lot of Buddy Wayne in there, which surprised me, and a lot of the head of the wrestling commission, which kind of surprised me, too. I would have liked to hear more from Lawler or maybe some other guys as well, but that was my only complaint with it. I was really blown away by it.
The head of the wrestling, you mean Guy Coffey?
Yes, thank you.
He was actually, he managed the Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis, and he was a figurehead that they used for an official. I don't know that he actually, I mean, I know on the DVD they listed him as the Memphis Wrestling Commissioner. I think that was just a role they had him play. He had no other, unless he had points in the office, and if he did, they were very small. But for the most part, Guy was pretty much, his biggest claim to fame was managing the Mid-South Coliseum, besides his on-air role. Never got to meet him, but from what I understand, he was a heck of a guy. And Miley, they could have cut the segment on Andy Kaufman in half and talk more about the '60s. I think they covered the '50s real good, of course, with Wicks and Sputnik, which were their two mainstays back then. And a little bit of Fargo, Jackie Fargo, because he wound up there in the 60 or 61. But then they glossed over the 60s. And I understand with trying to have people to actually talk about from that time frame, because there aren't that many people left. But Jackie's around. Wicks worked, you know, back and forth between there and the police department. Sputnik was not there as much after the 50s, but, I mean, you know, they could have talked about the Von Brauners and Saul Weingroth. They mentioned them, but they kind of glossed that period over. They spent too much time, in my opinion, on the Andy Kaufman thing and on the late 70s more than everything. Well, of course, it was Memphis, so by the late 70s it was Jarrett, so they pretty much, you know, I guess, focused enough on that, but the Andy Kaufman thing, I think, could have been cut in half.
You know what? When you say that, I think so too. Just because it's a story that's the one that everybody knows, and they, you know, like you said with the Von Brauners, they really glossed over tag teams. Period. I mean, you know, a couple of them get mentions, but it's not really, you know, focused on at all, and they do blow over it. I was kind of surprised with how they. And granted, you know, it went on for, you know, 20 years after that, and it wasn't until, 2001, I think, where they ended up going off Channel 5, at least for a temporary period of time. I don't know. It seemed that they kind of wrote it out, like when Jimmy Hart left, you know, that was kind of it. And it seemed that was a kind of a surprising spot on how they outroed the documentary, and I know it could have went on for, you know, 8 hours, 10 hours wouldn't do the story justice, obviously, but it seemed kind of odd they ran it out there.
Well, I mean, you got to figure, as all things are, I mean, they did, or I'm sure a lot of love went into making that, but they didn't make it just for love. They made it to sell, and, you know, mentioning people like Hogan and Sting and all those, I mean, that's what Hart talked about. His first little blip on the during the intro was all he threw out as many current names as he could to pass through Memphis. And yes, they did pass through Memphis, but, you know, I think they were trying to grab listeners or watchers, I should say, at the outset of it, and, you know, kind of ease them into the rest of it. But I actually enjoyed the extra segments on there better than I did the film itself. The best thing about the whole DVD was their little segment. I guess it runs maybe 10, 15 minutes long on what they call the Galento incident.
Oh, yeah.
The thing that happened in the early 70s with Mario and attacking Jarrett and Lawler. And they pretty much confirmed what I suspected all along, that was all Roy Welch behind all that. Roy Welch was not, he was the patriarch of the Welch, Fuller Fields, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera family, but he was not the best person in the world. He had a cruel streak in him that went to all of the Welches seemed to have had that cruel streak in him, and so I have no doubt whatsoever that he set that up. With Mario.
Yeah, Billy Wicks said the best at one point in there when he just said, you know, I think it was Nick Gulas. I think he did say Nick Gulas was the asshole, not Welch. But that could have been a documentary all in itself. I mean, you know, because Jared, you know, touches on the five crisp $100 bills, I think it was, that he had had for a guy that was completely destitute. And it just, I was just, again, I was blown away by that story. I was, you know, part of me was hoping there was some footage to it, but, you know, unfortunately there was not, or I guess really
well,
fortunately.
Actually, there wasn't to that particular, they did show a match, I'm not sure if it was the match that Mario ran into because it was only a brief snip, but there was a match from that time frame, 71, 72, whenever it was, with Jarrett working with Lawler on TV. That had to be later than that. Lawler was in here in 72 for a brief period, probably 73, 74. But they had a lot of good footage, and I don't know where they got it from. A lot of it looked like Atlanta footage that they were using and passing it off as Tennessee footage. But there was a lot of Atlanta stuff from Mario when he was the Georgia heavyweight champion. Some of the medics, they even took a match that's from Dothan Television, January 1977, with when they were talking about the midgets. It was a match between Diamond Lil and Princess Little Dove that they actually took and took the color out of it, made it black and white to make it look older.
Yeah.
But I recognize it because, you know, I've got that particular match on DVD myself, plus I recognize the referee, Jimmy McGuire, and I recognize that studio because I worked in that studio quite a bit. So, but that just tells you there's a lot of footage out there that I wish would come to light. Of course, the Memphis stuff is so up in the air as far as who owns what. I think it's spread out over four or five different owners as to who owns what of the Memphis footage. But there is, you know, evidently these guys got some of it. But right. that was interesting.
Well, one big cheer that went up in that general area, well, came from actually Kentucky. It was big screams of joy and happiness and just pure ecstatics. It was Jim Cornette. And the reason everyone heard all of this commotion coming from the Cornette compound was because Vince Russo, who was officially fired, he officially, I guess, resigned from TNA, as well as his son, who was working in production for the company. Now, Mike, I know you're not a big follower of the TNA and WWE scene, but I know you know the name Vince Russo and all the joy that he's brought to so many people's hearts.
Yeah, in fact, while we're kind of tying back into Jarrett listed on Facebook today. He said, "I'm gonna break confidence and tell you that Vince Russo is going to work for Jim Cornette at Ring of Honor." Of course, everybody that didn't know that situation bit on a hook, line, and sinker. Of course, he was just kidding. He was making a rib because of the fact of how what Cornette thinks of it, Vince Russo, but, you know, I don't know. I just wonder where he'll go or what he'll do now.
I tell you, I don't think there's really much he can do. And I don't, you know, I don't know where he lives. I'm not sure if he's still in Georgia or exactly where he lives right now. But, you know, Ring of Honor, obviously, Jim Cornette's there. Hunter Johnson's there, who plays Delirious. It's, you know, outside of that, there's Ring Ka King. Well, that's linked in with TNA. There was that group that was running in Spain that used Orlando Jordan in Ultimate Warrior. But, you know, New Wave, I think Rikishi was involved in that. But, you know, they're not running shows anymore. There's nothing really going on in the States outside of, you know, small independents. So I can't. You know, and how many of those small independents have TV, even like Showtime All-Star and things like that? This may be the quiet end of Vince Russo's contributions to the sports entertainment business. It's very realistic that that's possible. Of course, it's also as realistic that possibly Bruce Pritchard and somebody else or Dave Lagana and anybody else involved right now only last a year or so, and maybe they bring him back. Who knows what could happen, but I this could actually be the end, and well, what legacy?
Well, I know, you know, one thing I found out about the wrestling business, your career is never over until you want it to be over. You know, it's just like it was back in the territorial days. You know, you would have a booker for 6 months. months, a year, 2 years, whatever it is, eventually he's going to run out of ideas. He's going to start to repeat himself. He's going to get stale as your houses are going to go down, and he goes somewhere else. Unfortunately, now it's real limited, but it wouldn't surprise me to see him back with Vince's company in some capacity. I don't think he'll have as much power as he did initially because he's not family, but still, you know, the wrestling business is, you know, there is no end to it. I mean, it's like the mafia. You just go from one mob to the other. So it wouldn't surprise me to see him back in Vince Land in some capacity or back in TNA at some point. Like you said, you know, let him refresh, recharge his batteries, and go back again. You know, the business changes and makes so many twists and turns. That's the only thing about it. The only downfall I can see about possibly him going back to the WWE is because they have changed their product, trying to sanitize it a little bit, and he was, you know, not saying that he couldn't do that type of stuff. It's just that's not really his forte. His forte has always been the edgy stuff. So who knows? Good luck to him. Here we go.
One of the things about wrestling, you know, always changing, and, you know, unfortunately in modern times, it's always happened throughout the years, but there was more good stuff going on where it didn't show so badly sometimes with the recycling of bad ideas. And, you know, I would believe he would be back in TNA in some sort of capacity as opposed to WWE. Now, they did, when WCW went down, and I'm trying to think at what point this was, in 2001 or 2002, where they announced Vince Russo was back. He actually did go into meetings, if I'm not mistaken. J.J. Dillon was still there. I'd have to go back and double check. I think Dillon was there. But he went back, and it lasted about 2 days, and he was gone. And I wonder if he does have a position there, if there wouldn't be just too much backlash, you know, bringing him in. I don't know.
Well, I think he's been gone from you know, the WWE and WCW long enough where it's a fresh batch of people there. I don't think there's really anybody there. There may be a few behind the scenes that are not on-air talent that he has worked with in the past. But as far as on-air talent, it's all brand new. And it's a shame that, you know, it's something like they don't use people in the capacity of managers or mouthpieces anymore, because from what I remember of him in WCW, I never even knew who he was until he started showing up on the air. You know, as a personality, you know, as talent, and he's a heat machine. So, you know, I could see them using him as a manager in some way. But, you know, it would drive the internet people nuts because he's so hated. I mean, he's got a built-in storyline right there. So, you never know.
It's definitely possible. And I know we're running up on break here in a minute. You know, I will say this. You know, he was not fired from TNA. You know, they made clear to say that he had resigned. So, and Dixie Carter, you know, one of the things that has always been at least rumored about her was there was no way on God's green earth that she would ever fire Vince Russo. And that was pretty obvious with a lot of the ups and downs and even Hogan and Bischoff coming in who couldn't stand Russo. And he's still been there throughout everything. Even when Jarrett was on the outs there, he was still there. So, you know, again, depending on where his path takes and depending on what happens with TNA, who, you know, could certainly use a spark. And obviously WWE could use a spark as well. But I don't know. Just something tells me at some point he could be back in something dealing with TNA, or at the very least something dealing with Ring Cop King, because even though they've filmed everything that they're going to do, if Dave Lagana has been put in charge of TNA and is going to be doing that for a while, and this project takes off on the Colors channel, which can be seen in the States, but obviously is aimed, you know, 100% at India. So, you know, hey, who knows what could possibly happen there, because if that thing goes to a second season, they could use somebody to do something, and Vince Russo might be a good fit there. So we're up here against a break, and when we get back, we're going to be talking a little bit about the Ted Allen Memorial Show and doing a little bit something else. So we'll be right back.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
Saturday, February the 18th at Sprayberry High School for Super Clash. Live television taping. Don't miss Big Papa Pump Scott Steiner, Buff Bagwell, Hijo de Rey Mysterio, the SmackDown Invasion of Luke Gallows and Mike Knox, Johnny Fairplay from Survivor, and many, many more. Don't forget, tickets start in advance at only $12. Kids 5 and under are free. Visit UCWTV.com for all the information. Cards subject to change.
All right, we're back here on Ringside Wrap. I am Mike Sempervivi, along with Mr. Mike Norris. And Mike, do you know why that song by Whitney Houston is still on my iPod in 2012? Do you know why? Here's why. Because the way I've looked at it, I'm going to write this book one day. Professional wrestling has taught me everything, because I can relate almost anything in my life, you know, right back to professional wrestling. And in the 80s, WWF TV would always use popular music as, you know, as intro music. Obviously, I think it was Championship Wrestling used, you know, Michael Jackson's Thriller. That was the one where Hulk Hogan was coming out. But during the breaks, they would always have, you know, popular songs being played. And one of them was Whitney Houston's How Will I Know. And I think most of the songs I ever heard from that era that were used on those breaks, I still have today, because that's how pathetically influenced I was by professional wrestling.
Well, I understand what you mean, because I can't hear Bonnie Tyler's Holding Out for a Hero without thinking of Joe Pedicino and the show that he ran in Atlanta, that nine-hour show, overnight show that he did, because that was the theme song to it. And
I tell you what. Go ahead.
I got to meet one of the people who was a constant guest, and they kind of built that show around, because it was tied into, for a while, they was tied into the North Georgia All-Star promotion that Pedicino and Billy Starr ran. Of course, Billy Starr was known as Hillbilly Festus, and he worked the show this past weekend, the Ted Allen show, as Hillbilly Festus, and it was his retirement match. He won the Battle Royal and promptly retired. So I was talking to him, and I said, "So you're giving it up?" And he said, "Yeah, at the age of 63, I think I might as well." And I said, "Well, I can understand that."
You know what? He's still a pro wrestler, though, so that means I don't believe him. I still can't get over Mike Jackson hasn't wrestled since his last retirement.
Oh, yeah. Mike worked not too long ago.
He has worked.
Yeah, he was on a show not too long ago. In fact, I'm surprised he was not at Ted's thing. Because he and Ted were very close. In fact, that's how I met Ted through Mike. When I used to come over here, I used to come over to Atlanta from Birmingham and with Mike. Mike and I would come over together and would do TV. And if we were booked at the house show in Chattanooga that night, we would go to Cartersville and have lunch at Ted's house. And that's how I met Ted. And he was the first person I ever knew that had a VCR. An old top load, I don't know if it was a Beta or a VHS, but he had an old top loader one, and he had hundreds of tapes then, and this was in 81. So
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine the hundreds of dollars he spent on all those tapes, too, at the time.
Yeah, but if you know Ted, Ted was frugal. Let me put it that way. And him, Mike Jackson, they were both very frugal. It'd be a toss-up as to who could squeeze a penny and make it scream the loudest.
Now, this week, where was it at? It was in Villa Rica, Georgia, right? I love the, Nightmare to Remember. What an awesome, name for it. And how, obviously there were, Randy Rose and Pat Rose and Hugh Morris and a whole lot of names. How was the show and how'd everything go?
It was real good. I haven't heard a final count, but I've heard between 400 and 500 people there. And almost as many workers, actually. there was probably 65, 66 worker people from the business there. You mentioned Pat Rose. Actually, Pat wasn't there. The reason he did not make it. Randy was there. In fact, I spoke to Randy and saw Jerry Stubbs, both of them, for the first time in 31 years. And Stubbs, it looks very well. He had some heart trouble last year, but he looked real good. And at one point during the evening, they called all of the legends to the ring and had them, they introduced them and had them into the ring. And for some reason or another, my name got put on the list. I don't know if it was supposed to be a rib, but I was almost worried because of this. Somebody's doing something to me. I'm going to get out there and they're going to pull my pants down or something. And but nothing that bad. It was an honor for me to be included with that group of people that was there. Not only people that I grew up watching, like Bob Kelly and Curtis Smith, and people who I've grown close to over the years, Bobby Simmons, Charlie Smith, Ron West, who is kind of my overseer with the circus. Dundee was there. A lot of guys that I've known for years have never met face-to-face, but, through the Internet or whatever, have conversed with, like Bomber Jack Lord, who worked in Alabama, worked a lot of independents, has been working for years. Kind of like Ted, he was one of those road warriors that, even though the business changed, he stayed at it. But the matches were all good. Had some great talent there. It's a mix of old and new. Nick Busick was there, who was a big name
Billy
in Georgia during the 80s. Yeah, and he was there. Bo James from Kingsport, Tennessee, and his wife Joyce Gray. Well, Joyce didn't work. She worked. She was a manager. And got the, just like last year, got the best heat of the night. Boy, it's crazy how good she is as a heel, I tell you. But
hold that thought just for one, not for 1 minute, but for one big segment, because we got Mac and Murray on the line, so we're going to actually go to break here, and I want to talk more about the show when we get done talking to Mac. But coming up, folks. Former referee and a guy that did a little bit of everything. He's got some really good stories. Mac McMurray is going to join us, so we'll be right back on Ringside Wrap after this break.
Hi, this is Joe Perry.
And Steven Tyler of Aerosmith for Red. It's okay to rock and roll and party down. Just don't get in that 2,000-pound bullet when you're done and cocked. And please don't drink and drive.
I'm the one that jaded you.
A reminder that friends don't let friends drive drunk. A public service message brought to you by the Ad Council, U.S. Department of Transportation, National Association of Broadcasters, and RAD.
Janine Marks, a 12-year-old, was fairly normal. She spent a lot of time online. One day, she met a new friend. The new friend had the same problems at home. They liked the same bands. They worried about the same subjects in school. They promised to keep each other's secrets. They wished they went to the same junior high. The new friend had good news. He said he was going to be in Janine's area one Saturday. He thought it would be amazing if they could just hang out, go to the mall. Janine agreed. The new friend didn't want parents messing this up. Janine showed up alone. So did her new friend, who wasn't in junior high, wasn't nice, and wasn't a 14-year-old boy. Every day, children are sexually solicited online. Help delete online predators. Call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com to learn how to protect your kids' online life. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first party you attended? Who wasn't under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
How can we help prepare our kids for the future? Hi, this is Roger McGuinn. These days, our children face challenges unimaginable to us only a generation ago. We adults need to help our kids find something in school that really sparks their interest and keeps them involved. If that something happens to be music, the child will benefit in so many ways. Playing music in school is a great way to make friends. Studies are showing that kids involved in music are less likely to get into trouble. And kids who studied music find science and math easier to grasp. They tend to score higher on SATs. It has something to do with something called spatial IQ. So get your kids involved with school music. It's a great way to help prepare them for life.
A PSA brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, and the National Anthem Project, the campaign to restore America's voice through music education. Music, part of a sound education.
Universal Championship Wrestling in Marietta, Georgia. Saturday, February the 18th at Sprayberry High School for Super Clash. Live television taping. Don't miss Big Papa Pump Scott Steiner, Buff Bagwell, Hijo de Rey Mysterio, the SmackDown Invasion of Luke Gallows and Mike Knox, Johnny Fairplay from Survivor, and many, many more. Don't forget, tickets start in advance at only $12. Kids 5 and under are free. Visit UCWTV.com for all the information. Cards subject to change.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof,
be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
All right, we're back here on Ringside Wrap. I am Mike Sempervivi along with Mike Norris filling in for Les Thatcher, and we'd like to very much invite our guests on the line right now. Southeastern Championship Wrestling referee, Mr. Mac McMurray. Mac, how are you doing tonight, sir?
Oh, fine. There's a pair of mics up there tonight, huh?
And hey, both of us combined don't make one Les Thatcher, unfortunately.
I don't know.
But Les wanted me to get that in.
Mac, I'm going to show my age. Every time I think of Mac, I hear the song "Hey Lolly, Lolly, I'm the Telephone Man."
Anybody well, that's funny. I used to do that before I got in the wrestling business.
That's what makes me think about it. I know.
That's back in the old Southern Belle days. That's the long lost art back then.
That's when you'd actually get your phone fixed correctly, because you had no doubt they would come out. The little Bell telephone sign was on the hat, and things would actually get done. Never had that since.
If they called, you would go back. There, somebody would take care of it. We had our phone out up here. I lived 2,000 feet up a mountain in Del Rio, Tennessee, up here. And last November, a year ago, we were out of service for, 20-something days. And one of the weeks, I was in Tucson, Arizona at my ship's reunion. And my wife up here didn't have any sort of communications at all with the rest of the world. It was a real bad winter last year anyway. So I've kind of thumb my nose at some of the upgraded telephone service they're supposed to have.
Now, Matt,
well, Matt, what you got to do is get you some copper wire, and you can rig your own. I'm sure you still remember how to do all that.
Yeah, well, I don't. It's all computer now, Mike. It's it's you have to talk to a machine. Push one for English.
That's it. Now, Matt, how did you start? Because it started in the early 70s, if I'm not mistaken. Why did you want to get into the wrestling business or get around the wrestling business? And how did everything kind of start up for you?
Well, I lived, born and raised in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I went to one wrestling match. My dad took me in Lake Worth, Florida, just south of West Palm Beach. And my big thrill was standing next to Don Curtis taking a squirt in the men's room. And I'm sorry, not Don Curtis, Don Eagle. And that was the a thrill of my life. Now, I didn't know much about wrestling, but back then we saw it on black and white TV, those of us that had TV. And it came out of California or Chicago with Wilbur Snyder and Zabo. Chandler Szabo, and people like that. And I watched that whenever it was available. I boxed for 10 years, and I liked the contact sport. And my first wife was going to junior college one night in 1969. I took myself to the wrestling matches. And it was on Monday night, and it was at a polo grounds west of West Palm Beach at a big concrete arena with a tent on top. And I got in there, bought my ticket, went in there, and I knew the ring announcer. He asked me if I wanted to see the match for nothing and help take the ring down and usher. And I said, well, yeah, plus I got $5. And, back in 1969, $5 would almost buy something. So that's how I started. And a few weeks later, they found out that big tent over that polo grounds arena out there was not fireproof, and so they were dark for a couple of weeks, and then he moved into the West Palm Beach Auditorium. So I bought myself a ticket, got myself a permanent ringside reservation, front row seat, and session C. And the first night I went, I got up to go to the concession stand, and Ron Fuller was standing out there outside the dressing room. I don't know what made me stop and talk to him, but we got to talking and found out that he lived just north of West Palm Beach. He was operating out of Tampa, but he was building a home in West Palm Beach. So he said, he found out I was a telephone man, wanted to know if I'd come up there and pre-wire his house. And I said, well, sure, because back then they didn't charge anything for that. You did it on their time. They paid you to do it. But I said, yeah, I'll come up there on my time to do it. Well, I don't know what happened, but it never materialized. But one thing led to another, and I started going to the matches with him, basically because he wanted to sleep, wanted somebody to drive him. And we worked Miami and Fort Lauderdale and Fort Myers. And that went on until about, 1972. And he decided he wanted me full time. I didn't realize I was going to be working for nothing, but he wanted me full time. So I went ahead and worked out a notice with Southern Bell and started with him in 1972, August of 72. And that consisted of putting out posters and making the shots with him and driving him and ring announcing sometimes and timekeeping sometimes and helping set the ring sometimes. And then he and his wife were having some problems, so he ended up living out in my house every so often. I had a room for him. And along about 1974, he went to Knoxville as the promoter of the territory up here. John Cazano was talking about selling his business. So he went up there several times, come back with a big long face and a bunch of blue words, and figured he wasted his time. Well, over a period of time, things worked out. In October 74, off we went. I leased my house, and off we went to Knoxville, Tennessee, October 74, and created Southeastern Wrestling, which had the first show live show we did. I think we did $700, and old Ronald thought he'd died and gone to heaven. He'd never seen that much money coming through the gate. And one thing led to another, and we worked hard. We built it. We brought in some of the best talent of the time. We had Roddy Garvin and Orton Jr., and Andre came in occasionally, and Joe LeDuc, and Buzz Sawyer, and Tony Charles, and Jimmy Golden, and Robert Fuller, and the list goes on and on. We had a tremendous, team.
Now, and, when you, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. I just about run out of breath anyway.
How old were you in 1971? How old were you? Because you said you boxed for 10 years, you were established, you know, working at the phone company and everything. You know, how old were you? And when, you know, you made that jump, or when you made that move in 74, you know, a lot of the sacrifices, people forget about the sacrifices that get made with up and moving. And, you know, what reservations did you have, you know, as far as working for nothing and up and moving and going, okay, let's see where this takes me?
Well, it probably was a little bit of being dumb and also being enthralled with the business. I enjoyed it from the get-go, from the setting the ring and doing the menial jobs on up to being a big shot timekeeper. And it was a big decision, because I was as high as I could go with the phone company. I worked my way up to a cable splicer, and the next move up was first line management, which I wasn't interested in. But by boxing, I meant boxing. I boxed in the service back in the early 60s and off and on for 10 years. I didn't make a living at it. And all I got was a whole bunch of lumps and scars out of that. But I got more than that after I got in the wrestling business. But I was 29, and when I left the phone company. And it was a big decision. My parents about had a heart attack, but I know we came down one time, and Ron went out on their boat with my dad fishing. He caught some barracuda and everything, so it kind of broke the ice a little bit there after they knew him. They did desire to meet Andre, and we could never work it out where they could meet. They weren't really much wrestling fan. My dad was a boxing fan, and but the more I got into it, the more I liked it, and the more I learned some of the inner workings and the what goes into making a wrestling match, and the labor that goes into it, and the time that goes into it, and the dedication. I wouldn't change a thing to this day. People say, I know somebody asked me the other day, what would you do different? I said, well, I'd probably start about 3 or 4 years earlier.
Well, how long was it, you know, from starting to ride him around in that vehicle until he started to open the door for you and kind of smarten you up to what was going on? Was there any learning curve at all? Did he take to you right away and kind of let you in, or was it a long process?
No, he did. Nobody's ever smartened me up. I was very fortunate. The senior referee down there was Stu Schwartz, and he was always one of the best. And I started watching him. I realized that that wasn't that cane on wrestling, because I was about 225, 30 pounds. And back then, a big wrestler was about 250. And, of course, you had the LeDucs and some of the big guys that were 300-plus. But I was pretty sure I wanted to become a referee, but I never got in the ring until I actually came into Tennessee. And he to this day, has never smartened me up. I watched, and pretty soon you see a few things that let you know that it may not be 100% on the level.
Well, backing up a little bit, Mac, was Ron actually booking or running West Palm Beach for Eddie?
No. I think Eddie was calling the shots. Ronald ran West Palm Beach and a spot show on Saturday sometimes, and he was working for Eddie. Had West Palm on Monday, and he had Miami on Wednesday. Usually a spot show on Thursday and Fort Lauderdale on Friday. Tuesday they ran Tampa and Fort Myers. And then I think it was Tallahassee that ran alongside Fort Lauderdale on Friday. But he stayed over in that area, especially since he was living on the East Coast. Eddie gave him pretty much free rein of what he wanted to do. They had a good working relationship. And, of course, Eddie wasn't real keen on me because I wasn't born in the business. He didn't do a lot to help me, but Buddy Fuller and Ronald were the ones that really gave me the boost that I needed.
Now, going up
you were kind of around whenever the war broke out in Georgia, and Buddy went down to Florida and Lester came up to Georgia, kind of swapped there.
Yeah, I didn't know a whole lot about that. I found out the less I knew, the better off I was. In 73, before it came to Knoxville, we were going to move to Australia. Barnett and Buddy were going to buy that territory over there, and I was getting all my information on that we'd have two-day trips. It'd take 2 days to go from point A to point B, and I know my parents were tickled to death. They bought me all kind of clothes and everything, and that never fell. You know, that never worked, but I got a bunch of clothes out of the deal. And that's what I think Ronald Scott set his sights on, buying a territory somewhere, and I think he kind of wanted to stay as close to the East Coast as he could. His mom lived in outside of Tampa, and I think he wanted to be somewhere where he could get home there if there's any problem with her. But Buddy came in and helped us out a lot when we first came up here. And it started slow. I mean, we ran TV. Oh, Lordy. I want to say about 3 months before we actually made a show. And then we moved from a UHF station to a network station in Knoxville. And we started hitting four states. We hit Western Carolina, North Carolina, Western West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, and Eastern Tennessee, and as far west as Mid-Tennessee around Crossville. So we had a tremendous coverage. We could probably run 2 years, one show a night in different towns the whole time. But we established a regular territory, and sometimes it would do 1,100 miles, but the majority of the time we were home every night. And that made it a lot easier on the boys, too. It was a lot cheaper for them to – they'd rented apartments. They had an apartment complex. Most of them stayed. And then the ones that were going through, that we had a motel in the western part of Knoxville, $6 a night back then, the Family Inns. And the ones that were just coming through would stay there. And we had a real good routine. Everything went real smooth. We were really – we were very grateful for all the cooperation we got from the people up here.
Well, you guys actually expanded further along than John Fasano had, right? Because he had what, Knoxville, Johnson City.
Yeah, he also worked with Nick out of Nashville. Now we used some of Nick's people over here. We had Dale Lewis came over, and John Foley and Dutch Mantel and Jackie Fargo. There's another fellow that died here a few years ago. I can't remember his name. And Danny Dusick used to come. He was Nick's representative. So he made sure the tickets all balanced everything and everything. I don't know what the financial arrangement was. That wasn't none of my business, so I didn't want to get involved in that anyway. So we used Nick's people up for a period of time until we got on our feet. And then we used them. We trade talent every once in a while. And then we had our regular stable of pretty much the top boys in this part of the territory.
Right. That was a successful territory and you know, was strong. And, you know, Mike, you'll have to help me out here a little bit. Well, Mac, you as well, you know, being a guy from the Mid-Atlantic area and being a lot younger, I'm not sure how the transition happened into Ron selling. I guess, did he want to go down to the Pensacola end or something like that when he decided to make the move to sell to Ric Flair, Jim Crockett, and Black Jack Mulligan?
Well, we had a split in the ways in around Thanksgiving of 78. We had five of our top talent go off and run opposition against us. And we lost a lot of money on it. But, well, I take that back. We did lose a lot of money out of it, but I don't think we were running at a loss. And they were in the same situation. They weren't making any money either. They started operating out of I believe they were operating out of Lexington. And there's a lot of hard feelings there up until about 15, 20 years ago when we started crossing paths and realized we weren't as mad as we thought we were. but that's what initially started the demise of Southeastern. Fred Ward came up here, and he and Barnett apparently bought it. There again, that's something I never knew the final outcome of. We were interviewed over at the Hyatt Regency in Knoxville, went through, interviewed with Fred Ward, and I thought I was in there pretty solid, but there's a fellow, I can't remember the guy's name, Ralph somebody or other. He and I were like oil and water, and we were
Ralph,
working.
Ralph Freed. Ralph, yep.
Yeah, that's him. I know. I've studied
son-in-law.
I know. I set him up down at the bar where we used to go to all the time, called the Intersection, and I'd had just enough mother's milk in me to where I was going to tater him. And he walked to the door, and I was just about ready to let him have it. And Oldie was right behind him, and I thought better against that. So I think he was down at the reunion one time. I didn't have anything to do with him. I still kind of hold a grudge there. But we were in Elizabethton, which is up near Johnson City, one night. I was still hauling the ring for him and refereeing. And I could see we were going nowhere, so I told him, I think, if you don't care, let's work out a – I worked out about a six-week notice now, and that'll give me time to find something. He said, well, what do you say we just call it quits now? Well, first thing I'm going to do is throw them truck keys as far as I can throw them. Is that or get in the truck and drive on back to Knoxville and let him haul the ring in the back of his car. So, anyway, I thought better against that, too. And that's how we left it there. I went to work for a cable TV company, and Blackjack and Flair contacted me through one of their referees, Dave Hebner, and I was working the local shots for them at night and working a full-time job during the day. And in 83, my dad wasn't doing real well, so I moved back to West Palm Beach and got right in the Indies again as soon as I got back there.
So you were never involved with – you never came down to the Mobile End when they opened up the Southern End?
No, I didn't. I was following it through the grapevine pretty much when they went to Pensacola. And I was at the age where I needed to find something that I could depend on. And so I worked I retired from a little public works company south of a town south of West Palm Beach. But I was refereeing at night. I know when I first got down there, I was looking at the newspaper, and there was a – some lady at one of those Orange Grove tourist attractions said, lady alligator wrestler. I said, well, I got to go see who this is. And it turned out to be Liz Chase. And she was doing that and also running some shows in the southern part of Florida, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, some of those little spot shows. So I started working with her at night. And that worked out pretty well. And then in 86, I guess it was, I went up to the West Palm Beach Arena. WWF was in there, and I went out up there, went in with the boys, and ran into Jerry Briscoe. And I've known Jerry for years. And the referee got tatered up there in the ring and came stomping back there to the dressing room. And he didn't get paid enough to take those cuts. He caught a chair is what it was. It was a total accident. And I won't mention the guy's name, but Jerry said, how long will it take you to get your gear? Because I wouldn't bring him my gear. I didn't think about refereeing. About an hour and a half before round trip before I lived. And I come back, and I stayed with him 6 years. I worked the south, about mid-Florida all the way down to Miami for them. And I had a ball. Running to people I hadn't seen in years.
Hmm. Now, was it consistent? Now, was it just implied, too? Did you have anything in writing with them? Or is it just when they came into town, they just gave you the ring and said, come on?
With WWF?
Yeah.
I worked, Jerry, I think Shane McMahon was doing booking referees, and he'd send a booking slip to Jerry. Jerry get hold of me. Ran about one weekend a month, but we'd run three shows per night. And, you know, we started about 6 o'clock and get done about midnight 30, which made it tough on me, but I had enough time for where I was working to where I could take off pretty much what I needed to. And we worked Miami and maybe Fort Myers and Tampa in one weekend. And paid good. I mean, it paid real good. I didn't get any transfer or anything. They just paid me cash and hope the IRS didn't listen. And we just got audited last year. That's why. I had a ball. I kind of missed that in a way, But I had 6 good years with them, and they treated me right. I have no complaints at all.
Well, how do you think of the whole evolution? I mean, the fact that you were able to grow with Fuller and then, you know, open a promotion and see it play and go through all this and then see the business change in the ways that it did. When you were, did you just, you know, were you angry when it started to change? Did you care when it started to change? Did you just sit back and shake your head and just be thankful? Or, you know, because that's one thing we're talking to guys. Everybody's got their own opinions on how the 80s happened and what they felt going through it. What are some of your experiences as the thing went national and everything started to change?
Well, what I saw, of course, when Vince went on cable or satellite, whatever it is he did, it knocked out the little guy. It's hard to Vince would go on there and run for a couple of months and then go into the town. He could work just like we did when we first got established on TV, regular TV. He could go into any town in the country that had that show and do business. I only met Vince Sr. once. He was in Fort Lauderdale for something, and he brought a bottle of wine from Moolah, and I took it in for. And that's the only time I actually met him, but I was very impressed with him for that 15 or so minutes we were together. But I right now I think it sucks buttermilk. I don't like it. We've got kids up here that don't know an arm bar from a Hershey bar, and that's one reason I hung my boots up last November, a year ago, 2010, because I'd get in that ring with the old timers. I'd get in there and I could look at their face and their expressions and know pretty much what they're going to do, or I'd hear them call a spot and I know where to be, where I'd stay out of their way. These kids now call a spot. I've never heard of it before, and it turns out to be something that we used to do under a different name. But these kids are fast and they're flyers, and it's got to be where it's dangerous for me. I was taking some bumps I didn't need to be taking. So I'm a commissioner up here now of 5 different independent organizations, and they want to lean towards old school, but they don't know old school. And I can teach them and tell them, but without actually wrestling myself. Mickey Barnes told me when he first came in up here, he helped us out for a while. He said, don't ever let them put the tight side in to fill in for somebody or you'll never get back in the stripes. And I believed that, and I never did wrestle, but they'll ask me to watch a move or something when they're working out, and I can tell them if it's good or bad or forget about it. But they've got to be flyers, and a lot of these kids are getting hurt. I opened a gym here in Newport, Tennessee, 3 days a week, and last year I've got some pictures of Andre up there and of Garvin with a belt and me and Atlas, a bunch of pictures. And some kid came in here, he's about 6'6", and weighed 35 pounds. And he looked up there and said, man, you referee? And my first comeback was going to be, no, I just got out of prison. They got the stripes on the wrong direction, but I didn't. he said, I wrestled. And I don't say where or anything. I say, who trained you? Well, the guy on that road going over to Gatlinburg, he's got a BP station. He got a ring set up down there behind it. Well, the guy with the BP station taught this kid how to wrestle. So That's what we're dealing with now, Mike. We're dealing with these kids that I say don't know a hammerlock from a hemorrhoid, and a lot of them are getting hurt, and it's sad because they'll listen to you. They come to me for advice all the time, and sometimes they'll take it, and sometimes they go. It's not flashy enough for them, and they go ahead and do what they want to do.
Well, this is a terrible time to bring it up, but we didn't do it earlier on in the show. But I do. We should mention. Jesse Sorensen, who's a really young kid who's, I think, only been wrestling now. It's been less than a year. Works for TNA, broke his fractured C1 in his neck.
Good grief.
With Shima Zion, another guy, he did a moonsault off the top rope, on down to the floor, landed, compressed Sorensen's neck, and luckily as it stands now, he's got some feeling back in his arms and legs, but it was looking really, really scary there, obviously Sunday leading into Monday, but it seems like there is feeling coming back, and he could actually be back wrestling. I guess the doctor said, you know, in a year plus time, but you mentioned that. I should have just wanted to slip that in there just because this was the opening match of a pay-per-view. This was the opening match where a guy did a backflip off the post down to the floor in the very first match. Makes not a whole lot of sense to me.
No, and I'd get in there and towards the end up there. I tell the guys, you know, don't fault finish me to death. It's get me near the rope before I can get myself up a little bit because my knees and hips are shot. And one night here not too long ago, there was 37 vault finishers. Nobody's got a finish anymore. When I first got in there, a guy had come into the arena, and I'd ask him if he's a babyface or a heel, and what's your finish? Now what's your finish is non-existent. Everybody's kicks out of everything. And they've got them now, I guess it's something they've seen on TV, where I always count with a one and two and three. And usually when I get to two, I'll say, watch my count, just so I don't get myself in a spot. But they wait to that last fraction of a second, and the referee's got to make an ass out of him, he's got to make an idiot out of himself holding that count, or he's going to count these guys out, especially if it's a match that really means something. And all it does is put heat on the referee, and referees don't draw money. And I'm having a tough time getting that through some of these kids' heads. It's not impressive. If it happened once in a while, it's okay. But not every match and almost every false finish. I'm just too old school. I'm an old grouch. Right, Mike?
Exactly. And speaking of old grouches, you are actually probably one of either the bravest or luckiest men I've ever known. Just to give you a little background, Mike, Mac has been pulling ribs, have been brave enough to pull ribs on Danny Hodge, what, going on 20 years now, Mac, or longer?
No, back from back in the 70s. We started out when we first met.
I see. It's hard for me to believe that because I've always been fascinated with Danny Hodge, both as an amateur and as a pro, and had the honor to talk to him a couple times on this show. I know he's so good-natured, and everybody says he was a great guy, and even if you crossed him, he'd still be nice to you as he was stretching you and beating you to death.
Yes.
But I don't think I could ever have enough guts to rip Danny Hodge.
Well, I can't remember. He started it, actually. I know I don't know how much time he got, but I'll tell you a couple of quickies we got. He'd done something to me. I forget what it was. And I sent him a card full of glitter. He opened it up in his house down there, and, of course, the glitter went all over the place. And his wife, Dolores, has been screeching at me. That's been 10 or 15 years ago. And she's still fussing about getting glitter out of her rug. So, and then he did, so I can't remember what he did. So I got him back. I got one of these cans of possum meat. It's a deviled ham in a little round can. Looks like a snuff can. And it's a gimmick can. I got it at some roadside stand. So I sent it to him. I sealed it up real tight, sent it to him. Never heard a word. So about 6 weeks later, I get a sealed up envelope back in the mail. And I brought it in the house, opened it up. You talk about something stinking. He'd taken a little piece out of it and left me a note and said, I didn't like it, so I sent the rest back to you. So, and those are just some of the minor ones. He's not going to make it this year. The reunion was scheduled originally for the second week this year because something was going on with the racetrack, I believe. I never did know exactly all the details. But so he set up. He's always traveling, going to these amateur events. He's just on the move all the time, and he set it up the first week of Mobile this year, figuring that he'd make it the second. But of course, when they changed it, he was already committed, and he's very dedicated to that. Amateurs is his world. He loved it, and he loves it now, and he does everything he possibly can. Every time you see him, he's got a cluster of he's got a whole group of people around wanting to know how to shake hands and break your wrist and little things like that. But so he won't make Mobile this year. It just breaks my heart. We have an awful lot of good times down there. We had a lot of good times with everybody.
Now, speaking of guys who pull ribs, grew up a huge, huge Ronnie Garvin fan, and you're sitting up there on that mountaintop in Tennessee. What's it like when he decides that he's going to have some fun with you and buzz your house?
Oh, Lordy. Well, he'd threatened to do it for years. He'd been flying all over the place. I remember him leaving Middleboro, Kentucky one time. He and Ron Wright both flew. But he was up in Middleboro by himself. I think he loaded up Orton and Malenko and Rupert, somebody. So he had a plane full. And it was a grass strip. And it had a yellow light and a red light at the corners of the strip, and at the end of the strip was a mountain. And it was snowing to beat the band up there one night, and I went to the airport, took them to the airport, and they loaded up, and off they went. And I just knew that was going to be a big poof into that mountain. But, boy, he made it. And I couldn't see past my, you know, past my face, but he knew exactly what he was doing. And he threatened to kill Buzz the house. I said, yeah, you're FOS. Well, one night I was here by myself, and I heard him go over. So after I rolled out of bed and collected my thoughts, I got my rifle out. Of course, I had nothing on but a smile anyway, and I go out in my upstairs porch here and turn the lights on, and I look out, and I don't see anything. There's full moon to the east, and that's where the plane was. I hear the plane, but I couldn't see him. He had all his nav lights off. So he came around. I followed sound coming around. He got down and went down the valley and hit those landing lights. Every moonshiner and pot grower in East Tennessee went dove for cover on that and buzzed that house. And sure as grits as groceries, I could see the rivets on that thing. I had a 60-foot white pine tree not too far from the house, and it waved. I mean, the backwash of the props wiggled the top of that thing, so that came down the next day. And the blue flames under the DC-3 is a pretty darn good plane when you're looking at it about 60 feet over your house. And he did that several times. And I was a tad nervous the first time. Second time, I didn't care because I figured if he hits me, he's going to die too. So, but it was definitely a rib. I called him. He finally turned his lights on and headed out to the northwest. And I called him the next day to see where he was going, and he's taking some auto parts to St. Louis. But he's a Looney Tune. I mean, he comes up here and he hunts turkeys. He's got a shotgun, and he always makes me nervous. But I don't get in the bushes and go gobble, gobble, I'll tell you that. we've had some fun, and he and I have had some fun, too.
How often do you guys get a chance to go hunting together?
I don't hunt anymore, and my knees are shot. I'm not mobile enough. I got all my critters out here. I've got bears and I got deer and I got a three-legged fox.
They call up to him, knock on the door.
What's that?
The bears.
Well, I got one that rings the doorbell, but remind me, Mike, you're going to make the reunion, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay. I've got some pictures I'll show you. I've got some bears, you know, 15 feet away. We got a good understanding that they don't bite, I don't shoot. I haven't had any up here this year since December. They had hunting season up here, and they had a huge harvest this year in Tennessee. So, and of course, the weather's been warm, too. I doubt they even laid up. They may have gone into hibernation just long enough to have their cubs. But I've got a herd of deer up here. I've got a half dozen possums. I've got that one three-legged fox and a couple of normal foxes. And I got pictures of all that thing. I have to show Mike so he knows I'm not just whistling in the wind. But it's nice up here. He comes up here and stays quite a bit. And sometimes if he's got a shot, we'll go with him. I went to Somerset, Kentucky a year or so ago with him, and down to Ringgold, Georgia, when Thunderbolt Patterson was running something a year or so ago. And we have a lot of laughs. He's laid up now. He didn't make that Ted Allen thing in Georgia this weekend because he's got gout real bad. So I guess now's all we'll get at him. Now's the time to do it. As soon as I get my will written. We've had a lot of fun. Not much I'd change, I don't think. I just love this business like you wouldn't believe. I have no desire to do anything else.
But hey, you brought up the memorial show. We were talking about it, you know, right before we got on with you, too. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Oh, it's very good. Terry Lawler did one whale of a job. I don't know how much help he had down there, but that thing ran just as smooth as it could possibly be. After I got down there, I was supposed to have brought my referee shirt. For the trouble is, nobody bothered to mention it. So I heard part of what you're talking about. You had Roddy West there and Scrappy McGowan and Charlie, what's his name, Smith. And so you know, they even had from the senior citizens right down to the old men. And it just went very, very smoothly. I met James Gregory, which I talked to him before. He's a real wrestling fan. He's a worldwide known comedian. And we talked on the phone a couple of times. He was interested in going to Mobile, and he stays booked all the time on the weekend, so it's kind of hard. So hopefully he'll make it by the Red Roof Inn and meet some of the guys. He knows Charlie, and he knows Bobby Simmons and some of the Atlanta people. But the whole thing down there, it just went so smoothly. I was just so impressed with it. And I said, I had to stay down there that night because I was working a show in Waynesville, North Carolina at 3 o'clock on Sunday. So when I got back, I said thank you to Terry for the job he did, and also suggested some boys up here that might be willing to do it, even if they find out that it's a benefit show. And, you know, you're going to be down there working for nothing, but the experience is just priceless. And it was just awesome. The sad thing with Ted, I was at the Fan Fest in Charlotte 2 years ago. It was Atlanta this past year, and the year before last was Charlotte. And on Saturday, I stayed at Ronnie's house, Garbage House, and Ted came in late that night. I had the spare bedroom with the bathroom in it, and I knew Ted was there because he was sleeping in the den and peeing out the door. So I knew he was there. And so we got together over there outside the gimmick room, Johnny Walker and Skander Akbar and Ted and myself. And as luck would have it, the next day Johnny had a massive heart attack. And 2 weeks later, Ted and Skander were dead. And out of that four, out of two, sitting there 2 hours talking, out of the foursome, I was the only one that left unscathed. And that kind of gives you the creeps.
Well, Mike, you got anything else?
Yeah, I want Mike to tell us about his foray into the, you couldn't call it the television or movie business, but Mike... Was it one or two commercials for BC Powder, Mac?
We did one. Yeah. I listen to Jobboy Billy whenever I can, and they were asking for people to make the commercials. You know, you might get to have your own commercial, blah, blah, blah. Well, I sent a little resume, and I got a call, a conference call from Dallas, Texas, and set it up where I had Tim Horner, another wrestler, and I would do it. They met me at the gym that I open up in the mornings, and this lady about two axe handles wide and came up there and wanted to see how we handled being in front of a camera. Of course, we'd done TV for years, no problem. So she seemed to be happy with that, and we got a call, or I got a call, and we were to meet, to go to Nashville for the shoot. So I met him on I-40 truck stop, and we went over together on one afternoon, and checked us into a nice motel over there, a hotel over there, and I got the room by the railroad tracks. He got the room the other side where he got a good night's sleep. And the next day we got up and went to some guy's house. I don't know who it was, but they had a real catered lunch out there for us and all the crew. And we had to wait till 3 o'clock in the afternoon when school got out because they had it about, oh, Lordy, I don't know how many floors up it was, but they had to haul the ring up there. Bert Prentice, I believe, was the one that provided the ring. And it took about 6 or 7 hours to do that 31-second commercial. But it went real smoothly, and we wanted to try to do another. I went over pretty strong on this one, and we're going to – actually, all the dialogue was ours. They gave us the catchphrase, which was "share the relief," and we each come up with, you know, some ideas and make say the dialogue that we had done. We didn't have a script, so we just winged it, and it came out a lot better that way, I think. And come to find out that they only use you one time, so we've never been able to do another one. We had another time where he gave me a BC. I took a bump, and he gives me the BC instead of him because it was a true story. When he first got in the business, about 1977 or 78, he was doing TV in Knoxville, and I forget, he just did a job, and he got pounded pretty bad. So I went back to the dressing room, and he's laying on the floor with his tongue hanging out. I thought somebody put a necktie on him. So I gave him a BC, and that's where the story came from. It was a true story. And it was... Well, we had an awful lot of fun with it, and of course, haven't exactly been on the top of the waiting list. I haven't heard any more from anybody, but I still take BCs.
How did they pay you? Did they give you a year supply of EC for your payment?
No, they gave me a bunch. We got $500 for doing the shoot, and it came almost $20,000 total because we get residuals every time it played. It played for 13 months in 18 states, and I got Garvin saw. No, we did the my wife and I did the Oprah Winfrey Show back in '89, and I got a call from Garvin, and he was going to the airport and happened to see the show and called. Had to call him and say, I thought you quit doing TV and all this nonsense. But I had plenty of BCs for a long time, and I say to this day, we were standing up in the ring during the shoot, and they were taking a break, I guess, and there's a guy standing beside the ring. Horner said, I ain't take the BC, I'm going to take stand back. Turned out that was the representative for BC. And he kind of just smiled. Tim looked, turned about 16 shades of red. And this guy just kind of smiled. He said, we make stand back and BC and goodies too. So that operation makes all those different pain relievers. So we kept our job.
Well, Mac, before I let you go, I got to ask you now, because doing this show, usually Mike Norris isn't here. It's usually Les Thatcher here with me. And is there anything you can give me to hang over Les's head or to stick on to Les?
Well, let's see. Lordy.
Now, remember, I don't want to die.
No, I understand that. I also know we're on the radio. So... Probably the thing I'd hang on him would probably be left unsaid. Maybe if I get to meet you in person, I'll tell you.
I'm
not
going to
tell Norris
that.
He'll put it on Facebook.
No.
Oh, man.
Mac, I want to thank you so much for coming on tonight. And, I mean, would you be willing to do it again?
Anytime you say. I don't have a lot more to offer, but I really enjoyed it. I did one for Cloverleaf in Chicago or outside Chicago some months back. And it was very short. And I hope your audience had a good time, had a laugh with it, with the rest of us. But I really enjoy doing these things. And anytime, just give me a shout. I'll be more than happy to help you out.
Thank you so much. And I know Rich Tate thanks you as well. And everybody, we're going to be back right after this break. More Ringside Wrap.
Hi, this is Mark Anthony Farad, recording artist, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. Music is one of the most important things in my life, but nothing is more important than life itself. So choose a designated driver. Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
How I long to hear you sing beneath the clear blue skies.
A public service message brought to you by the Ad Council, U.S. Department of Transportation, National Association of Broadcasters, and RAD.
Fairy residence, Tooth speaking. Sorry, there's no credit fairy here. What's that? He magically raises your credit score? Yeah, there's no credit fairy. But you can improve your credit by paying bills on time and keeping your credit card balances low. Money under your pillow? Sorry, kids only.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. Brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
You want to know one of the best things I remember about going back to school each September? Music class. Hey, this is Kathy Matea, and I remember a moment when I was in junior high school and I was playing the French horn in the band, and the part that I had been practicing made absolutely no sense when I played it alone. But when I sat with the rest of the band, suddenly we became something bigger than the sum of our parts. It was a magic moment. It was a light bulb moment. It was a life-changing moment for me. Don't rob your kids of this opportunity. Music is crucial. Music and the arts give us our soul and make us not just brains in a jar passing tests. Give your kids this gift in their schools.
A PSA brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, and the National Anthem Project, the campaign to restore America's voice through music education. Music, part of a sound education.
Tradition rises from the ashes. Universal Championship Wrestling returns to Gwinnett Friday, February the 24th at the North Atlanta Trade Center for live television taping with Payback, Big Papa Pump, Scott Steiner, Buff Bagwell as the NWO reunite Tejo D. Rey Mysterio, Luke Gallows and Mike Knox of the SmackDown Invasion, The Rock and Roll Express, Hot Like Lava, Johnny Fairplay of Survivor, and many more.
For tickets, visit the UCWTV.com website or the Trade Center box office.
Card subject to change.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
This evening and on Whitney Houston night. Just some tells me we won't be having a Bobby Brown night when he passes away, but we'll see. that was
that be a
fantastic.
Dog Bobby now, Brown night?
That's maybe a Larry Brown night if we like basketball enough. If everybody's into it that evening, if Larry Brown passes, but I hope Larry Brown doesn't pass. In fact, I hope Larry Brown coaches the Washington Wizards one day, but that's a completely other story. Mac McMurray was never talked to him before, and is he always that fantastic?
What's that?
Is Mac always that fantastic?
Yeah, well, according to him, yeah. No, Mac's a great guy. Mac, I've met Mac. Actually, Mac and I never worked around each other. He was pretty much tapering, you know, his career down when I got into the business. But met him through the reunion down here, and he's just, you know, he's one of those that never meets a stranger. The guy's just he's just a wonderful person. And like I said, anybody that's got a good enough where he can rib Danny Hodge is pretty much it. I mean, his personality and everything is great. In fact, we do have him on again, and something he wasn't able to get into tonight, but he and Andre were pretty good drinking buddies at one time. Whenever Andre would go into Knoxville, Mac has posted pictures of various places of he and Andre out on the town, and he couldn't drink. Well, I don't know. He may be able to drink as much as Andre at that time. I don't know. I've never asked him. But Mac's a great guy. Got a great bunch of stories. And, you know, everybody that ever worked around him, he's, you know, he's just like Bobby Simmons and you know, Scrappy and well, I won't say Charlie. I won't throw Charlie into that group. But nobody's ever got a bad word to say about him, and that's unusual.
That's
somebody who was in the business as long as he was.
One thing I love about your show, it's one thing I love about doing this show, too. I mean, we all, you know, like our share of, you know, little inside things and off-the-record stories and things like that, and, you know, the little bit of scandalous things every once in a while. But one thing I love doing this show and listening to the shows on this network are just the positivity that comes from, you know, the interviews like this. And, you know, God, wrestling's so filled with so many, you know, scandals and nasty things and things that drive you crazy and just very dark things. It's always nice to hear, you know, these types of stories. And it's just very faith reaffirming in being a wrestling fan for so long.
Yeah, that's very true. It's something Bobby Simmons has said on more than one occasion, that we all had to get out of the business to realize how much we actually all love each other, because, you know, our business was very much a brotherhood. And we had Ed Moretti on our show last year, who last week, who, you know, none of us had ever worked with Ed. But, you know, there were people that he worked with that we did work with. There were things he experienced on the road that we experienced on the road, ribs that he pulled, we pulled. I mean, it was just, you know, wrestling was a brotherhood. I'm assuming it still is. And looking at the way the Ted Allen show was this past weekend, it's very much a brotherhood still, and the camaraderie and everything is still there and still very strong. And, you know, I mean, all we had was each other. We relied on each other to work in the ring, to make our matches look decent and believable, because it takes two people to do what we did, or actually three, if you include the referee, which we should, because a good referee can make or break a match. But it was a cooperation, and, you know, but that was only, you know, for the most part, anywhere from 10 minutes to an hour at one time. The rest of the time was spent on the road, sitting in dressing rooms, stuff like that. And that's what we all seem to miss. Wrestling was fun, but, you know, it was painful too. The fun part of the business and the thing that we all miss is the camaraderie. And that's why things like the Ted Allen Memorial Show, where we have people there, the Gulf Coast reunion like we've got coming up in Mobile, the Cauliflower Alley, stuff like that. That's why the guys enjoy it, because they're just able to hang around with their friends, see people that they haven't seen in many years, or see somebody they saw, you know, the week before. It's, you know, it's the camaraderie and the brotherhood that survives all of that other stuff. And that's what most of us have taken away from it.
That's what, you know, a lot of it. I was actually listening to an interview with Lance Storm where, they were talking about, I guess at the time it was just talking about when his going into the WWF after WCW had shut down and was bought out, and was, you know, they were asking questions about guys in the back. He was just talking about playing cards and all the different card games and everything, and it just, you know, it's one of the things, you know, when listening to you guys talk about playing cards, you know, and then, you know, still hearing today that all these card games still exist and all these things still go on, even though you don't have these types of baloney blowouts and guys today don't have some of that stuff. There's still, for a lot of guys, a strain that runs through with some of those things that you would do in the locker rooms.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
How important were cards? Because I'm a terrible card player.
I never played cards with anybody. I, you know, my time in the business was so short. I mean, I worked less than 3 years in the business. I only worked full-time for about a month working for Fuller. So where I saw the same, you know, people and traveled together with the same people. The rest of the time it was, you know, whatever outlaw I could pick up here, come to television over here. And I worked with a lot of the same people and got to know people, but, you know, I was still... From the beginning of my career to the end of my career, I was still in that phase of sit down, shut up, and be quiet. And you know, back then, that's how you gained people's respect. You did whatever was asked of you. You know, I would, no matter who they put me up against, I would do whatever they wanted to do for a finish. I would you know, I never had a problem putting anybody over because that's what my role was. And, you know, I never thought, well, you know, I should get a push or anything like that. And I never asked questions. I mean, Jerry Oates and I were talking about this last week. You know, he pretty much, even though he was had family in the business, he was the same way. You know, that's how you learn. That you just, you know, you ride in the back seat with whoever's driving and you keep your mouth shut, you know, until they speak to you. But I never, what Mac, going back to what Mac said about being smartened up, I was never truly smartened up either. I mean, when I was going through training, I was learning how to sequence and how to put a match together and all that stuff like that. But I never once asked, you know, is it real? Is it not real? You know, who does this? Who does it? I never asked any of that stuff. And I've had several people tell me that was one of the things that they respected about me. And, you know, they were willing to use me a little more than some of the guys who, you know, first thing in, is this fake? You know, when do I get to win and all that stuff? And see, I never did all that. I was just so happy to be in the business, you know. You didn't even have to pay me, and sometimes they didn't, but, you know. Or at least
that was part of the game.
Yeah. just in my case, I was smart enough to know I was never going to be, you know, go very far with it. As much as I loved it, and I had loved it since I was a kid, and it was all I ever wanted to do, but I was smart enough to know once I was in there that I was not good enough and not coordinated enough to really do other than what I was already doing, and I certainly didn't want to do jobs the rest of my life. Not that that would have been bad, but I wanted to make a full-time career out of it and everything, and I realized I was not good enough. So I got out while I still could. As much as I ache now, I can imagine what I would have been had I had a 15- and 20-year career.
Now, did you work for Lars Anderson? One of the reasons, you know, thinking about this was I was actually watching Polynesian Pro on FNN Score, actually, this past weekend, the old show
Lars,
that you said.
Lars was running, he had already left the Atlanta office. He and Steinborn had gone in together and were running in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and had a training school there. And I never worked for him. I went to a couple of shows to see, you know, how they were, because I had friends that worked at Jackson, worked for him. Ted worked for him. And but Lars's school, from what I saw, was basically, give me $500, I'll get you a pair of tights, and I'll get you booked on Atlanta TV, and that's as far as you go. And, you know, that's the extent of what I'm going to do for you. And I don't know if you know or have heard of the incident, the famous incident where Bruiser Brody put a guy in a wheelchair and kicked him in the mouth and then pushed him in front of Gordon Soley's podium. But that gentleman was a Lars Anderson, quote unquote, student. And I was there, I was in the studio when that happened. And the guy never worked a match in his life. And his first opponent in his very first match is Bruiser Brody. So Brody was a good guy. If you knew what you were doing and you'd work with him, he was a good guy. But he didn't suffer fools very well, and he didn't like to be shown up. Well, this guy got in with him, and the first thing Brody did was that one-arm body slam, scooped the guy up. The guy panicked, wrapped his arms around Brody's waist, and wouldn't let go. So here's Brody on national television, you know, with this big build-up, and he's the new monster heel and all this stuff, and he can't throw this guy because the guy's locked onto him like a leech. So he finally got him off of him, threw him out of the ring, and tatered him, put him in that wheelchair, and proceeded to kick his face in, and then pushed him in front of the podium. That was it. Mike Jackson. Mike Jackson. I was, like I said, I was sitting in the studio because I wasn't working. I had just driven Jackson over there. So we were leaving and going to Columbus TV after that. And Jackson said, I got your book on TV next week, because I had never worked TBS before. And he said, I got you your first match on TBS on TV next week. And I said, okay. And he said, yeah, you're working Brody. I said, you're crazy.
Oh, man. How cool.
You know, I was lucky. I never had anybody try and stiff me. I never had anybody try and hurt me. Everybody that I ever worked with, after the matches came up, thanked me for working with them and all that stuff like that. And I never had any real bad experiences in the business. Of course, a lot of that came from the fact that I did what I was asked to do. You know, even if it was something I'd never done before, you know, I'm even nervous about it, but I would do it anyway. And I would do my best to make it look, like it was supposed to look. But I was just so, I'm 6'5", and at that time I weighed about 210 pounds, and I was just gangly and gawky and just uncoordinated, and I was a mess. You know, I probably was as bad as George Gould ever was. But there's not a whole lot of me on video out there to prove it, so I can lie and say I did okay.
That's the best part about being a host on one of these shows too, is this is leaving the legacy right here. you were held down, you were. Now, I know we're about to go to break here real quick, but just because it's getting to WrestleMania time and there's always a big spike, whether people want to pay attention to it or not, even, if you don't pay attention to the scene, you usually start rolling into WrestleMania. And people's, tensions kind of perk up. Now, WWE TV has obviously left a lot to be desired as far as the lead up to this WrestleMania so far. I'm sure it's going to kick into more of a gear here once the Elimination Chamber, which I believe is this Sunday, is over with. But any thoughts on the WrestleMania and the event it's turned into now? And does your interest peak up at all in the regular scenes?
No, I mean, I haven't watched any of the current stuff in several years. Now, every once in a while, I'll turn on, WWE just to see what's going on, and maybe I'm catching it at the wrong time, but I never see anybody working. I only see them standing around talking in the backstage or something like that. And this one, I know we have a tendency to joke around and mock the business and everything the way it is now, but, if you can't mock success. I mean, they've got their fans, and that's what their fans are used to seeing. That's what their fans enjoy. It's not what I particularly enjoy, but I'm not going to, like I said on my show a couple months back, I'm adverse or versatile enough where I can enjoy a Marx Brothers movie and then turn around and watch Avatar. They're both enjoyable to me for different things. I still would particularly, I'd rather watch a Wilbur Snyder versus Vern Gagne match as opposed to what they're doing now, because I guess because I was in the business, I understand, what was drilled into me is what we were supposed to be doing, and it's kind of all gone by the wayside now. So I really don't get into what they're doing now. The guys are, I don't think there's a person from my generation that would say that the people that in the business now aren't better athletes than we were for the most part. But they take crazier risks, and back in our day, it's kind of like what Mac was saying. Everybody had somewhat of a finisher. You saw something that if a guy did something in a match, you knew it was over. As a fan, it was over. And if a guy kicked out of it, it was something. And now they do so many false finishes and everything, or they seem to. It just seems to be, it's anticlimactic. But it's a different style. And it's just not something I particularly get into. I'm interested in WrestleMania, going back to your question, mainly because of the Hall of Fame and who they put in. I know this year, I haven't heard anybody other than Masters. Who else are they putting in?
It's Mil Mascaris. It is the Four Horsemen. In that, it's the Horsemen in being JJ. They're saying Flair. Obviously, there's contractual issues there. Tully, Arn, and Barry Windham will be in there. And I'm trying to say, oh, and Edge, I know for sure, is also going in too, because his career with his neck is obviously over with for sure. So I know for sure that group's going in. I'm not sure if they've announced anybody else quite yet.
And the main event is still going to be The Rock and Cena?
That's the line, although, you know, they do those multiple main event things where Sheamus is probably going to face somebody. Let's go with Daniel Bryan, say, because technically he won the Royal Rumble, so he would be, quote-unquote, in the main event spot. But, yeah, realistically, Rock Cena is obviously the, you know, the moneymaker of the show. Which, yeah, and that's going to be interesting, too, if they start announcing names for the Hall of Fame, which, you know, more, which I assume they probably won't have too many, which is why they haven't announced too many more. How many guys from the Florida scene actually go in, considering it's in the Orange Bowl?
Yeah,
or not the Orange Bowl, I'm sorry, wherever the new stadium is now. I'm stuck in the past.
Has Rocky Johnson been voted in yet? Their Hall of Fame is not... He already is in the Hall of Fame.
Yes, he and the Samoans went in. They were inducted by The Rock. I want to say about 05 or so. I can't remember which one. It was WrestleMania 24 or something like that. But he did make it in.
Down that way, Wyndham makes sense because he's there. I just hope he's well enough to attend. I haven't heard lately how his health is doing. But I'm hoping, you know, he's well enough to attend. And I guess that makes sense that was the second, you know, that grouping of the Horsemen was, I guess, the longest and or second longest behind the original four. And a lot of people prefer that one from what I've seen on message boards and stuff like that. I think at that point in their careers, Barry certainly brought more to the team than Ole did. Of course, Ole was, you know, in and out of semi-retirement. And, you know, there was 5 or 6 years where Barry Windham was probably one of the best workers in the business. He just, you know, he was kind of, I've heard several people compare him to Dick Murdoch, to where, you know, he loved the business, he loved what he was doing, but he was never, you know, so dedicated that he was willing to carry the NWA strap or something. And he was in it for the fun, just like Murdoch was. And for the fun and to make a living at it. And but there was a time, you know, like I said, a stretch of 5 or 6 years where Barry Windham was probably, if not the best, one of the best workers in the business.
Yeah, that's in my wheelhouse of time where I had, you know, the 90-minute matches with Flair, and I had a chance to see, you know, a little bit of Florida TV, but it wasn't really till... He went to Charlotte, then went to the WWF, you know, pretty quickly after that, then back to Charlotte where, I mean, he was fantastic. And for me, even though I, you know, I loved the only version for me as somebody growing up in that time, you know, with Wyndham and Blanchard and Anderson, Flair and JJ, that was by far the coolest unit to me. And, you know, arguably, you know, for that era, at that point, Ole's career was by far the best working unit of the Horsemen and kind of the one everybody thinks of. And I know we're going to break here in a minute, but also want to mention, and Rich let me, you know, reminded me of this, and I kind of forgot about this name, which makes 100% sense because of his career at Florida State, being the first WCW African-American heavyweight champion, and his obvious career in the WWF, Ron Simmons. It probably looks like he's going to be a shoo-in for this year.
Well, good. That he certainly deserves it.
Absolutely.
I think that match, I don't know if it was – when he won the title, was that on a pay-per-view? Was that a Clash of Champions? Because I seem to remember watching that.
No, that was – that was up in Baltimore. That was – go to that show. It was a house show that they – Bill Watts surprised the hell out of everybody, and they made it there, and then he went, and I think it was a clash after that where he faced off against Vader again.
Well, maybe they just – I just remember seeing the match. Maybe they played tape of it or whatever. But that was probably one of the last, you know, distinct things that I can remember while I was still watching semi-regular was him beating Vader for the title. That ranked right up there to me with Benoit and Guerrero winning the titles in WWE because how hard Ron Simmons had worked, and he came out of the territorial system. You know, he was trained by Hiro Matsuda, and from everybody I ever heard talk about him, was just a great guy in the business. I've never met the man, but I was always a fan of his work. I mean, he just seemed like a natural for the business.
Excellent. And everybody says, too, the role he was able to play, you know, which was somewhat comedic coming out of the Dark Undertaker thing, and they had the Acolyte Protection Agency, the APA, with him and John Bradshaw Layfield, where they both basically got a chance to kind of be themselves, and he was able to, you know, because he got a lot of short end of the stick to me, as far as I'm concerned with, you know, WCW was at a weird point then, and then, you know, Rich is going to kill me if I don't go to break, and I'll just ramble on about this for too long, so better go to break here so Rich doesn't yell at me anymore. We'll be right back.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Red Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
Tradition rises from the ashes. Universal Championship Wrestling returns to Win It Friday, February the 24th at the North Atlanta Trade Center for live television taping with Payback, Big Papa Pump, Scott Steiner, Buff Bagwell as the NWO reunite Hijo D. Rey Mysterio, Luke Gallows and Mike Knox of the SmackDown Invasion, The Rock and Roll Express, Hot Like Lava, Johnny Fairplay of Survivor, and many more.
For tickets, visit the UCWCD.com website or the Trade Center box office.
Card subject to change.
All right, we're back here on Ringside Rap. Mike Sempervivi along with Mike Norris in here and talking the rugged world of professional wrestling introduced by Whitney Houston. Now, Mike, I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to the show all together too much, but usually this segment of the show, this is the one I hate to say it sometimes when it comes to the current scene, but I like racing through everything we have to get to the interview, and then after the interview, we got to do a little bit more of modern stuff, which, yeah, it doesn't bother me too much, but it always leads into my favorite part of the show, which is talking about old school things, which I, you know, obviously you know a little about. And one thing we've talked about, and is up on the ringsiderap.com. Born at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Our book selections and a lot of the books that we've read, Les, Rich, and I, and some of our favorites. And one book we've kind of been talking about and hinting at talking about for a little while now, and I'm sure you've probably read it, Tim Hornbaker's National Wrestling Alliance book, The Untold Story of the Monopoly that Strangled Pro Wrestling. Have you had a chance to read that book?
Yes, in fact, it's I probably own probably less than 10 books, but that was one that I did purchase. And great book. In fact, Tim is in the middle of another project now. We're finishing up another project on the heroes of professional wrestling from, I'm not sure, I think he's going from like the 20s up through current. I've helped him out with a couple people with that book. I gave him some information on Ken Lucas, who I am glad somebody is finally recognizing that Ken Lucas, you know, needs to be involved in something like that. I've tried to bring up his name as far as being put into the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, and everybody just kind of laughs it down. But in digging through the information that I put together for Tim, Lucas wrestled from 1959 through 1985 full-time. He held 142 different championships. He worked in 8 different territories, worked on top everywhere he worked. And, I mean, from almost from day one, I mean, he... within his second year of his career, he held the Western States Tag Team title with Sputnik Monroe at one time and then with Art Nelson. So the guy just had an illustrious career. Worked with, he wrestled every NWA world champion from Dory Funk Jr. to Ric Flair. But he's just so overlooked because there's no video on him. There's just not a whole lot out there on him. And to me, to overlook somebody like that and say, well, you know, not enough people are familiar with him, or, you know, he wasn't on, there's not enough video out there of him, so he doesn't deserve to go in the Hall of Fame, to me, is just ridiculous. But,
well, you know, he's one of the ones you're going to have to continue to fight the good fight on, because, you know, a lot of people know about the regular voting aspect, and some people let their ballots out and things like that. But what I've noticed is when it starts getting thrown into more of a historical portion, sooner or later, those guys tend to get recognized a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, I don't think so, because, I mean, like I said, Ken was not only because he's a friend of mine and everything else, but just he's just somebody, like I said, his credentials, if you look at his overall career, are just, you know, he deserves to be in there alongside people that are already in there. And the knock that, well, he wasn't around during the expansion, well, neither was Jim Landis. Jim Landis is in there. You know,
yeah.
Who has seen video on Jim Landis? Who was alive to see Jim Landis work? Yeah, he was a world champion, but, you know, titles were political things.
Oh, yeah.
Like they were usually won in the ring, so.
And obviously, you know, at least with him, you can point to drawing power in New York and things like that. But, yeah, I mean, you make a very fine point. You know, another thing, since we're talking to a referee tonight, one of the other criminally overlooked parts of the Hall of Fame, and I know this has got nothing to do with Hornbaker's book, but just because we're on it real quick, referees in the Hall of Fame, no Tommy Young, no Red Shoes Dugan, no a lot of guys, Tiger Tori, yeah. There's name ref, you know, a million and one referees, Scrappy McGowan, that should be in the Hall of Fame that are not. I mean, no referees are actually in the Hall of Fame. I mean, Jimmy Lennon Sr. is. There's lots of guys who I hate. They deserve to be there, but so it's amazing to me that the third man's not there.
Exactly. Because, like I said, it was a three-way or you know, for the tag team match, it was a five-way or three-way dance, and you know, the referee played a big part of it. Their job was to not be noticed, but at the same time, you know, they worked the crowd or watched the crowd, and they, if need be, if he was a trusted referee, he could change the finish. So they had carried a lot more power than some of the boys did, you know. And you look at somebody like Leo Garibaldi, who, even though he was booking, he kept himself in a referee's role. just so he could be out there. He could see what was going on. He could see if something was hot. You know, he thought it might work to bring him back for the next week. These things are finished. And the rest of the point of he and Roger Cody, when they went into Florida, I think it was the Monroes they were. But that is a very good book. Just a lot of the machinery behind the scenes that goes on with the promotions and stuff like that. We were talking about earlier the partnership of Roy Welch and Nick Gulas. I would love to see somebody like that's got the investigative techniques that Tim does to do a book just on that promotion, just on that partnership.
I've been calling for that for years. I mean, the story you can get, I mean, my God, I mean, the fact that to get the Hatfields, I mean, it starts with the Hatfields and McCoys, and then you can continue to write that story. The fact that somebody hasn't done it and made a movie out of it just boggles my mind.
Well, just not even talking about the Welch family. I mean, there's a book right there itself, just the, all the generations of the Welch family and how they were so involved with the wrestling. But the partnership of Gulas and Welch was such a dynamic because a lot of, and if you've seen Memphis Heat, several of the guys tell that, and everybody I've ever talked to that worked under each one of them, Nick gets a bad rap because a lot of cases as far as, you know, the payoffs and all that stuff, because Nick carried the facade of being the hatchet man when actually it was Roy Welch. He would let Nick play bad cop, and he would play good cop, but then he'd go around, the guys would get his ear, and he would agree to something, then he'd turn right around and tell Roy, well, or tell Nick, we're not going to do it. You know, he always made, it was very rare to find the two of them in the office together, because that way you couldn't, they played off each other. They play you in the middle between the two of them, but if you could catch them together, you might actually get the truth out of them.
Well, Mike, and I got to stop right there because we're almost out of time here, so we can't get the plugs in. So let me actually do it for Les here real quick. Doc Young's Wrestling Weekly with Vic Sosa and Will Strauss. Les will be on there this coming Saturday at the WrestlingObserver.com website and Wrestler's Eye Radio with Mike Johnson. I think that's actually coming up tomorrow as well. If you want to get a hold of Les, you can at Les Thatcher at EPWT.com. What you guys got coming up tomorrow night?
We have the one and only Gorgeous George Jr. on our show tomorrow night.
Awesome.
I am
awesome.
So looking forward to this because I grew up watching George. He was in the Gulf Coast territory quite a bit, and I am really looking forward to this. And then next week, we're going to be joined by Bo James and Bill Dundee. So we've got some good things coming up.
Awesome. And for, you know, everybody out there listening, obviously you already know, go to ringsiderap.com, go to georgiawrestlinghistory.com to keep up with the shows and all the shows up here on the network as well. What I got coming up on Sports Byline this coming weekend, Wrestling Observer Live with Brian Alvarez. Probably recording another Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare for the WrestlingObserver.com website as well. And I think that's about it. So, for everybody, and Les, who's out there at home, Mike, I want to thank you so much for filling in for him tonight.
My pleasure.
And I
really know we're
here
to fill Lester's shoes, but I appreciate it.
I'm sure he's going to think you did just fine. And I want to also thank Mac McMurray as well, too. Just, you know, again, great interview, and I cannot wait to have him back on this show as well. So for all of us and for Rich Tate hiding in that little studio behind the glass, wish all of you a good night and have a very nice week, and we'll talk to you again next week.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network.
Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.